Good morning. I'm going to call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. First order of business, approve the minutes. Representative Magnus moves approval of the minutes from both January 13th and January 20th meetings that you have in your file folders. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Magnus. Members and guests, first a couple announcements. This is the Ag Committee, and we do have a pot of coffee on for anyone in the audience that haven't had enough this morning. Please help yourself. We always have that available to everyone in the room, not just committee members or staff. Secondly, please silence your cell phones if you can, or shut them off. And if you don't, for those of you that are new, our only rule is if the cell phone goes off, there's a coffee can up there, and you owe a buck to that coffee pot so we can keep serving coffee. And if you answer your cell phone, it's $5, okay? So we're kind of self-policing, but we'll go silent if your cell phone goes off. So be prepared for that. Members and guests, what we have today is the Green Acres issue before us. And yes, I think about Hank Kimball and Arnold the Pig every time I hear Green Acres, just like you, but that's not what we're talking about. Obviously, Green Acres is an issue that was before the legislature last year and will certainly be before the legislature again this year. What we're going to do, just a little explanation of how this is going to work today and next week. What we're going to do is hear as much testimony as possible today. And by the way, I have a lot of people signed up. If you haven't signed up and want to testify, see one of our pages that are working. There's two pages working here in the room, and give them your name, and they'll bring it up to us, and we'll make sure that we get you on the agenda. Basically, we're going to take testimony, and you can look at the agendas that are out and in your folders. And then next week, on Tuesday, we will hear anyone who's got a bill in and puts a hearing request in, we will hear their bills. And then what our intent is to put together one committee bill to leave here and go down to taxes to represent Marquardt and represent Winchesky, who will then look at what we as outstate ag members in particular, what we see and what we feel we should be doing. Then they'll put their eyes on it down there and hopefully move something through the committee and out. So that's kind of the process we're going to have. I would also point you to a number of pieces of information in your folders, members. There's articles from newspapers, clippings that we've been collecting the last couple weeks. This has been obviously something that's been out and about and talked about in many corners. So as an introductory also, I want to remind people, and I know we're going to hear it from our researchers and others, this program originally started as an agricultural production acre set-aside program, or not set-aside, but tax relief program. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind as we think about changes or adjustments we need to make. This was never a wetlands program. It was never a conservation program. Now, that's not to say that we as lawmakers can't make it that, but I suggest that it is something that to preserve and enhance ag production acres, pasture, tillable acres, those types of things. Now, I think part of our duty is to understand if we talk about those acres, are we talking about those acres alone or about an ag unit? I think a lot of times we have peripheral acreages that are part of that, and we're going to have that discussion to understand if that should be part of this going ahead. You will find great variance in Green Acres. It's used heavily in developing counties. We have some counties in the state that do not use it at all, and we have others that have very limited use of it. But one thing is certain, most of us have gotten a call from someone or weighed in by some group, and it's a real concern of a lot of legislators. And so that's why we're hearing it here, again, to put some agriculture eyes on it, and understand this, too, and I'm going to finish with this, and then we'll get into the testimony. Whatever we do with Green Acres, we don't have to pay for it. This is paid for by the local jurisdictions through property taxes. So everything that is reduced tax-wise, not a bad thing, and I'm for preserving ag and other lands, but what you're going to hear pushback on is that cost then is spread out on other properties within the district, residents in town, businesses on Main Street, etc. So realize that while it's easy for us to put together something, it does affect our local units of government, and particularly the citizens that live out in our districts, because that burden is shifted across other properties. So I think that's important to keep in mind as we move forward, too. Any comments or questions from members before we go on what we're up to here? All right, very good. Welcome to the committee, the first group we're going to hear from. And again, there was a large audit report put out. Green Acres was a piece of that. Now, we're going to hear quickly from the auditor on their findings and what kind of generated it. You do have in your bill files the evaluation, the summary of what they're talking about. So that's there, and you can follow along. Welcome. Introduce yourself. We're on tape, and by the way, we're also being broadcast here so that folks around the state and others outside of this room can pay attention and follow along. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer, who was the manager of this evaluation. I want to just very briefly explain who we are and how we came to do this evaluation, because I know some of you in the audience and possibly some of the newer members may not be familiar with that. The Office of the Legislative Auditor is an arm of the legislative branch, much like the General Accounting Office is for the Congress. We do financial audits and investigations. We also do evaluations. And I think the important distinction to make here is that we only do evaluations when we are asked to do them by legislators and with the authorization from the Legislative Audit Commission. And the Commission has a variety of criteria by which they decide. We typically get 40 or 50 requests for evaluations, and the Commission goes through a process and ultimately decides on 6 or 8 topics that we evaluate each year. And Green Acres and Agricultural Land Preservation Programs was a part of that topic selection process last year. And so we did this, again, because there were concerns expressed by a wide range of legislators. Our role is to bring back to the legislature an accurate and objective presentation of the facts. We do offer recommendations, but we also understand that as we present issues and problems to the legislature has to take into consideration a wide range of interests and perspectives and ideas. So we do not engage in lobbying the legislature for implementation of our recommendations. We are given an opportunity to make a presentation of our findings and recommendations, and then we turn those facts and those recommendations over to the various legislative committees, individual legislatures, to bring forth the other perspectives and ideas that need to be considered to make a law, change a law. So, Mr. Chairman, I want to now turn to Ms. Howard to present to you in the audience what we did say in our report on Green Acres and Agricultural Land Preservation Programs last year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jody Howard. I work with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I will describe briefly what our report of last year contains. You have in your packets both a copy of the slides I'll be going through, as well as the full report from last year.
And members, I don't have the full report in my packet, so maybe I do. Oh, now I got it.
I'm going to start by getting just an overview of what we found and then get into some of the detail, although rather quickly. Overall, we concluded that the Green Acres program is an effective way of reducing taxes for farmland. However, it doesn't help everyone who might be eligible for the program. We found that it's unclear whether the program's goals actually include benefiting certain types of owners and certain types of land that has been eligible. We also found that some of the eligibility criteria had problems. They weren't workable, or they created inequities in the program. Plus, as the chairman has already suggested, the Green Acres program has not been implemented consistently around the state. And I'll get into that in more detail in just a moment. So so everyone has a common understanding of how the program works in its basics. I'm going to quickly go through some of the things that I think everyone needs to understand. First of all, the Green Acres program applies only to farmland where that land value has increased due to non-agricultural factors, things like development pressures that would push up the price of that farmland. To be eligible, the land has to meet certain requirements. There are ownership requirements. I won't get into the details there, but there are ownership requirements in law. There are size and land usage requirements. Some of those are that the land has to be classified as agricultural. It has to be at least 10 acres in size or be a nursery or a greenhouse. And it has to be primarily devoted to agricultural uses. And I'll come back to that term again in a moment, but it's a key one in this discussion. Now, there had been a requirement that the land produce a certain amount of agricultural income each year, but as you're probably all well aware, in the 2008 legislature, that particular requirement was eliminated. Now, we found that the Green Acres program is very effective when it comes to equalizing property taxes for farmland. And it does this by significantly reducing the value of the farmland for tax purposes. Because the Green Acres land is valued according to its agricultural use, not according to what the assessor might say is the best and highest use of that land, but it's the agricultural use. And the difference between those two can be quite large. I'll show an example. In 2007, the average value for an acre of farmland in the four very fast-growing counties just north of the Twin Cities metropolitan area had a value of, on the average, $6,500. The Green Acres program, though, reduced that value to an average of $1,900. Well, that's a threefold reduction in the value of that farmland. It's very significant. Now, due to those lower land values, of course, the owners of land in the program pay less in property taxes. And we estimated that in 2007, the program reduced the property taxes for participants by about $35 million. Now, that $35 million is paid by nearby landowners who have land, but it's not enrolled in the program. It doesn't qualify for the program that hasn't applied. Beyond the tax benefits of the program, Green Acres does defer special assessments for the owners of that land. Now, when owners sell their land, they're required to pay back some of that tax break that they had received. Now, historically, landowners were required to pay back 3 years' worth of the tax breaks they had received. But again, as you probably are well aware, this changed in 2008 for some type of land, for land that was non-productive land. And that the law now requires up to a 7-year payback for acres that are deemed non-productive. Now, any earlier years of tax break, though, represent a permanent tax reduction for that landowner. So we did, as I said already, conclude that the program is quite effective at reducing property tax burdens for agricultural landowners, although it does have some limits, and I want to discuss those limits right now. First, the program had not been implemented statewide. As of 2007, when we were doing our work back then, 35 counties did not have any land enrolled in the program, even though some of the county assessors there told us that some non-agricultural factors had indeed influenced the value of land, at least in some parts of their counties. The map that you'll see on this particular slide shows the percentage of farmland that has been enrolled in the program, again, as of taxes assessed back in 2007. The counties in white are those where no land enrolled in the program. The darkest green on this slide represents the heaviest concentration of land enrolled. Well, the second reason that we thought the program's effectiveness is limited is because some landowners simply decide against applying. They might not like the idea of being involved in a government program. They might be on the verge of selling their land soon. For whatever reason, they decided they aren't going to apply. As an example, in the Twin Cities, Seven County Twin Cities area, a little bit less than half of what land agriculturally classified is actually enrolled in the program. So that's more about, it was like about 53% was not. Then the third reason we thought that the benefits for tax equalization were limited is that not all landowners may be aware of the program. We've interviewed the county assessors in 48 of the counties that had some land enrolled, and we found five of those counties that had relatively small numbers of acreage in the program. they provided information on the Green Acres program only when a landowner requested it of them. By contrast, most of the counties send out mailings to potentially eligible landowners to make sure they're aware of it. There were controversies over who received the Green Acres benefits, and we found four types of cases where it was legal to qualify for the Green Acres program, and many landowners did, but we concluded it was unclear whether the program's goals actually included those four types, and I'll talk about those now. For instance, it was unclear whether people who aren't farmers should qualify for the program. There are many landowners who own land that is classified as agricultural, but they're not farmers. A second group was landowners who could benefit from the program even when most of their land was not in agricultural production. Let me talk about an example. We heard about one, well, there were several, where it was questionable because you had something like an 80-acre parcel, 15 acres of which were tilled or used for agricultural production, but the remaining 55 acres were wooded land and not used for agricultural production. Now, there are many parcels that have non-tillable acreage as a part of them, and we didn't question that. What we were questioning was those parcels where most of the land was not productive and where that value could be valued separately by the assessor. We said that those kinds of properties are questionable because the tax program, the tax deduction program, gives a preferential treatment to those acres, even when similar land not attached to a farm would not get that same kind of tax rate. The third type of land that we thought was questionable in terms of eligibility was land that had higher values, but they increased because of demands for recreational pursuits like hunting. And then a final questionable case was small farms, those of 10 or 12 acres or so. Now, I do want to make clear that all these types of land that we thought had some questions about them were perfectly legal and under Minnesota law. But we said it was important for the legislature to review these because of, well, two primary reasons. First of all, the benefits for the program are sizable. Those that are enrolled do receive sizable tax reduction. And then secondly, the tax relief for those enrolled in the program is paid by shifting that property tax burden onto other community members who aren't participants in the program. So that's why we thought it was important to review the types of land that had some questions as to whether they actually were in line with the goals of the program.
Representative Fowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick question. What do you consider productive farmland? Is it just tillable acres, or is it pastures, or hay ground? If it was productive at one time where it was tillable and they grew, let it grow up in trees so they could harvest the trees at some time, would you define what you consider productive farmland for me, please?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, of course, it's the assessor who makes that definition, who will, in practice, determine whether land is productive or not. But in terms of our looking at it, we only wanted to know, in terms of whether it was tillable or not, that wasn't a concern because obviously there are a lot of farms where they're not tilling the land. They're using it for pasture, for livestock, or things along those lines. So that wasn't the question. I think the question was more, is most of the land used for agricultural purposes and can it be valued separately? If it's not, if most of the land is not used for agricultural purposes, can it be valued separately by the assessor?
Okay. Continue.
We concluded that there were problems, too, with some of the eligibility criteria for the Green Acres program. There were a number of problems with the income criterion, but because that was eliminated last year, I'm not going to get into those. But two problems that we identified are still here. One is that how assessors classified land as agricultural was somewhat, and still remains to be, somewhat subjective. The statutes on classification of property define types of agricultural products that will qualify, like grains or livestock or bees and apiary products. But the statutes don't specify how much is necessary to qualify. So it's really up to the assessor's judgment as to how many acres with how many beehives will actually qualify as agricultural land. We thought there was a similar problem with statutory language regarding the Green Acres land that is supposed to be primarily devoted to agricultural uses. the statutes don't define primary, and so, again, it's a subjective judgment on the part of the assessor. And interpreting it was a subjective, as we found during the course of our work. We found that the administration of the program varied in some ways considerably as you went from county to county around the state, and we concluded that that can result in unfairness. Again, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but we found variation in how assessors were defining land as primarily devoted to agricultural use. We found variation in how they verified income back when that was still a part of the law, and also in how they provided information to landowners about the program. Now, besides the focus on tax equalization, which, of course, is specified in statute, it is a tax equalization program, we did look at the program's effect on farm land preservation. The statutes do not explicitly say that this program is intended to preserve farmland, but so many people think that is a part of it, we thought it was important to look at that. We concluded that the program does not effectively preserve farmland for the long term, and for the following reasons. First of all, the program does not require a long-term commitment to the land by the owner. The program is not restricted to regions that have been zoned for long-term agricultural use. And, in fact, an owner in the Green Acres program could divide and sell his property at any point. There's nothing in the Green Acres program itself that prevents that. The amount of the tax benefit is small when you compare it with the rapid rise of farmland values, particularly in some parts of the state closest to the metropolitan area. And finally, we thought the effect on preserving farmland was somewhat tenuous because it's not targeted to high-quality agricultural land. It's not targeted to land that's at risk of soon being developed. And there have been changes over the years in terms of land that has been in the program but then sold and obviously acreage removed. The last thing I want to talk about is a summary of the recommendations we made, the key recommendations, and then some of what happened in last year's tax bill that were related to what we recommended. First, we said that the legislature really has to take a look at those types of land that benefit from the program and clarify in statute what types should receive the Green Acres benefit. Well, the legislature last year did this in part, but only in part. It did remove eligibility for some types of land, as I'm sure most of you are aware. It created this new Class 2B classification for property that's considered to be rural vacant land, and that kind of land then was made ineligible for the Green Acres program. Now, I do want to point out that Class 2A, which is the agricultural classification, does include land like sloughs and wooded limb breaks and land adjacent to ditches and some others where the land was impractical for the assessor to separate the value. The legislature also made a change that would remove from eligibility land enrolled in conservation programs. A second recommendation we made was to, in tandem, eliminate that income criterion, which I mentioned earlier, at the same time that it would add specificity to the statutes to define better how land ought to be classified as agricultural and to define better how Green Acres should be defined as primarily devoted to agricultural use. Well, the first part of that was done. The income criterion was removed, but the second part was not done. And finally, we recommended that the Department of Revenue continue efforts that it had already underway to make sure that the Green Acres program was more consistent statewide. And the legislature reinforced that by making sure that that would happen. It required statewide implementation by all counties as of tax year 2011. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll conclude my remarks. I should point out that obviously there were additional changes made last year, but not from, I think, from the recommendations we made and conclusions we made in our evaluation.
Okay, thank you. And by the way, I forgot to mention, I see a bunch of my colleagues in the audience. You are all welcome to join us here. I see Cornish, Jackson, Kalen. I'm going to list them by name. Eastland, Anderson, Emmer, Raskowski, Kiffmeyer, a lot of legislators that have a lot of development. So feel free to join us at the table. This is your table, too, so even if you're not on the committee. Any questions for the auditor? Otherwise, we're going to keep humming along here. I appreciate you coming. We'll probably have questions for you as we go. You all got the handout now, so you have that information. We're going to call House Research up. I also forgot to mention, while we're officially done in this room at noon, I'm not certain yet that we'll get through all the testifiers by then. I personally, this room won't be used again until 1, and so I personally will stay here until we get through all the testifiers, and anyone else who wants to hang out is welcome to do that, because I think it's important we hear from people as a committee, and so I will stay around. And I would tell testifiers, again, keep it short as you can. A few minutes. If you've heard your testimony, someone else has already said it, you can come up and confirm that. If you can come up in groups, if you know someone else in the room, I know the assessors are coming up as a group, that would be helpful too. Because again, we want to hear from as many people as we can, but we want to hear the unique viewpoints also, so we can get a broad brush on what's going on. House Research is here. I know they've been doing some of these presentations around the area and have put together a little short synopsis for us. And introduce yourself and proceed any way you wish.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Karen Baker, House Research. You should have a memo in front of you. It's dated September 16th, and this is a memo that Steve and I prepared last fall that answered or tried to answer miscellaneous questions and also a lot of misinformation that was out there, and we've used it at a number of different hearings and presentations. We're working on an information brief, which isn't done yet.
I don't know if we have a memo, so we'll look for it and we'll get copies to people as we go, just for your edification. Now it's coming around.
Okay. Before summarizing kind of the key changes that were made, I'd like to make two really important points, and they show up on the front page of that memo towards the bottom. And the first thing is that given current law, the way it stands, if a landowner does decide to leave his or her land in the Green Acres program, there will be no change in property taxes on the land as a result of the 2008 changes. This was something that was a very much miscommunication. Now, it is true that there could be some impact in the future depending on what happens to that land and if that land is sold or transferred at a later point. But the other thing is that none of these changes are effective until taxes payable, or none of them are effective for taxes payable in 2009, which is the year that we're in right now. They basically take effect next year. But again, there is going to be this additional taxes that will be payable in November of 2009 on this land that you take out. Steve's going to talk about the timeline and where we are with that timeline. On the second page of it, I'd like to go through, and Jody did a very, very good job of summarizing a number of things that the legislature did do in 2008, so I'm going to kind of quickly go through so that our testimony doesn't take too long. But you can see 4 points that are listed on page 2. And the one item is that a new class of property was created. It's called rural vacant land. It's defined as rural undeveloped land not being used for ag production or ag purposes. It has the same class rates as ag land, so it shouldn't result in any changes in tax burden for property tax purposes, but it will be categorized and tracked separately for valuation purposes by the assessor. The land that is in this new rural vacant land class will no longer be allowed to be in the Green Acres program for future enrollment. So any of this rural vacant land, which is Class 2B, which Jody mentioned, is able to stay in Green Acres if it's already enrolled, but it will not be able to be enrolled in future enrollment. This is also true for all the government-sponsored conservation programs, such as RIM and CREP And I think the idea behind that is that these programs are not productive. And that is one thing that was discussed, and is the question of what's productive and what's non-productive. Although the Department of Revenue has to work with assessors on defining it, in general, productive isn't just till, but it includes mowed, if it's mowed for hay, if it's followed, whereas non-productive is your woods and your wastes and your sloughs. So, you know, there isn't a black and white line here, but I think Revenue is working to try and make that as clear as possible with what fits in each category and working with the assessors on that.
Question. When you have rural vacant land, and maybe this is one for the assessors when they come up or the department, I'm not sure. For full disclosure, I'm a real estate appraiser, appraised farm and commercial property. So I see a lot of assessors' cards and valuations out in the courthouses. And you're right. When I appraise wet, waste, and road as one category in my appraisal because it's really worth a lot less. It holds the world together, so it's worth something. But it's not something you can develop or utilize that way like a wooded lot might be or some lakeshore property adjoining farms. So are you telling me the rural vacant land would encompass all that on a farm? Woods, waste, road, wet, small pieces, big pieces? Is there a break, you know, how do we break that down? Because those values vary greatly out there. As far as land valuation.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, some language did get put in the law that talks about if it's impractical to value separately. And we can talk about that later, and or, you know, maybe it is better to ask the assessor or the Department of Revenue that question. But for the most part, productive land does have to produce an ag product in general. So, or capable, I guess, of producing it when you're talking about mowing it for hay. And so it can't just be a pasture that's totally sitting idle and that hasn't been used for years. But if it's been mowed for hay, and I think kind of three of the last 5 years is what the department uses as their guidelines, that then it would be considered unproductive.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Hines from House Research. Just the exact language states that the Class 2A property, which is agricultural, may contain property that would otherwise be classified as 2B, including but not limited to sloughs, wooded wind shelters, acreage abutting ditches, and other similar land impractical for the assessor to value separately from the rest of the property.
Okay, moving on, the other thing, and I think I've mentioned this before, but I think it's important to keep in mind that the changes that were made in the 2008 are only changes to this non-productive land. Anything that is considered productive ag land has had no changes. It is in green acres, and there is no change that's been made. So I think your focus should be on this non-productive if, in fact, you are looking at making some changes. The number three item here on the sheet talks about that all the land that's currently enrolled in Green Acres was grandfathered in the program for as long as it stays under current ownership. And there's a couple exceptions or a couple things that need to be mentioned here. One is when the land gets classified as rural vacant land and when that land is removed from the program, then it's subject to a 7-year payback instead of a 3-year. And yet there was a provision also put in that had this window of opportunity to be able to take it out or the intent to take it out, and Steve will talk about that timeline, before the January 2009 date, assessment date. The second thing is that in the future, landowners will no longer be permitted to withdraw just small tracts of this rural vacant land on a real piecemeal fashion So if any rural vacant land is withdrawn, and really this should say on each parcel, so they'll be looking at each parcel. But if you had a parcel that was 40 acres and you wanted to withdraw 10 acres of rural vacant land, but there were really 15 acres there, all 15 acres would have to come out. That's the way it has been interpreted and the way it was drafted. With that, I think what I'll do is turn it over to Steve for just some comments on where we are now and the timeline, and then we'll stay here and answer any questions and that members might have that we can.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, brief on page 4 of the handout that Karen was describing, it's actually a memo from the Department of Revenue, but we included it in our memo as a way to sort of indicate that this was the official word. You notice this memo was dated September 12th. There had been a fair amount of confusion around about what some of these deadlines meant. Department of Revenue was working with the assessors all summer to try to nail down some of the details related to this legislation, and it took until about this time before they were able to come up with this interpretation of this deadline that became very important to the to how this scenario played out across the state. The law spoke in terms of a January 2, 2009 deadline for pulling land out of the program, and the Department of Revenue's interpretation was that that the way things should work, or the only way they really could work, was if that deadline, that January 2 of 09 date, was viewed as a date by which taxpayers had to indicate an intent to withdraw their land, which would not be binding at that point. So that was communicated to assessors in September. Assessors, some of them did better jobs than others at getting that word out to their taxpayers that this January 2 deadline was the first deadline they were really up against, and even that was not a hard deadline. That was a date by which they had to indicate intent to withdraw. And the reason is that then triggers a lot of work for the assessors to determine for all these potential withdrawals what the tax implications would be, both in terms of the back tax payment that would be due and in terms of their future taxes under that land if they withdrew from the program. So this is all related, as Karen said, to the non-productive acreage that was in Green Acres, and given that they were given this window of opportunity to withdraw some or all of that land right away, defined by this deadline, to still be subject only to the 3 years of back taxes as opposed to the 7 years under the new law. So going into now at where we stand now on January 21st of 2009, many landowners across the state have indicated to assessors their intent to withdraw some land, and the assessor's offices are busy trying to gather information and make the determinations necessary as to what the back taxes would be if they do indeed follow through on that intent, and also, to the extent possible, what their future market value would be on that land that they would take out of the program. So there's a lot of, presumably, and you'll hear more from the department and from assessors, there's big piles and inboxes of work to be done for assessors trying to determine all this, and then presumably sometime in the summer they will notify these taxpayers of their situation with regard to their intent to withdraw, and then the taxpayers will have, so sometime in the late summer, presumably that deadline's a little unclear yet at this point, to say yes, I want to go ahead and follow through on that intent, or no, I don't. And the department has determined then that if they do withdraw, the back taxes would be due on November 15th, 2009, which is the same time their second half payable 09 property taxes would be due. So there's a lot of work in process in the assessor's offices, but as of now, for the most part, not a lot of decisions have had to have been made yet by taxpayers. There's a lot of pent-up situation that could still be altered by something you might do this session. Now, I think you might hear from some. There may have been some people who transferred property during the latter half of last year. There might be a little problem with how those have been handled. But by and large, most of this is pending stuff and subject to change this session.
So, Mr. Hines, one of the things you just said was January 2nd was an intent kind of deadline, but it wasn't hard and fast. Is there leeway in how much going into the summer? Obviously, this is where the final decision is made. Do you suspect that people might have till then to actually file something with the assessor?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume that they would not have, they would not still be able to file a new request. They were encouraged to, if they had any thought that this might be an option they wanted to exercise, to go ahead and file it by January 2nd. So hopefully they did, but you know, we're not in the county offices and we're not hearing.
And again, I think that's one of our concerns, is if someone missed that deadline, and because if it stays a 3 rather than a 7 year payback, and if you're a person who is thinking of retiring and selling off some development land, that's a big difference in the money's realized, and that's where some of these decisions are being made. And again, to people that are in it and want to stay in it for the next 10 or 15 or forever years, they really have no concern. It's for those that really are thinking in the next year or two they may want to spin off a piece or sell their farm for development or other reason. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing I'd like to mention is we always anticipated that with the intent the taxpayers had, that if, in fact, let's say you had, you know, 80 acres, and you really weren't sure if you were going to spin off all 80 or if you were going to spin off 10 or 15, that you ask the assessor to look at that and tell you what of the 80, you know, is rural vacant land, maybe all of it is, and that then the choice would be made at some later point. So that taxpayer may decide that, yeah, I only want to sell off or take out 20 acres of it. So the commitment wasn't kind of an all or nothing either. It was more of, but we did encourage them to, you know, think outside the box as to what you might want to sell of this or transfer. And so that was, I think that's what the department was hoping that people would do.
Okay. All right, let's keep moving. Thank you for your presentation. We'll get the Department of Revenue up here quickly. I think there's two points here. And again, while we love you guys and want to hear from you, we got a lot of out-of-towners here that we need to hear from today. We can have you back anytime. So if you can keep your comments short and to the point, we'd appreciate that today, and we know your phone number. So introduce yourself and proceed as you wish.
Mr. Chair, I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the Director of the Property Tax Division of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And next to me is John Hagen, who's the Assistant Director. His area of responsibility is the assessment and classification of property, so we all point to him a lot during a lot of this discussion. But yeah, we'll keep my comments brief because I know you've got a lot of testimony here. Jody Hauer and House Research covered a lot of the overview, so I won't cover that. What I'd like to do is maybe just emphasize a couple of things. One is, as Steve Hines indicated, that the administrative policies that the department engaged upon to administer the new law did establish this January 2nd as a more flexible date than what the statute really required, giving some flexibility, I think, for both the assessors and for the taxpayer with all the new legislation that came about. So we have been trying to work with the assessors and understanding the concerns that taxpayers have, try and build in some flexibility in terms of how we administer these new provisions. And I think Steve summed it up pretty good. As we're sitting here right now, the January 2nd was an administrative date put in place for intent purposes to withdraw. We told the assessors that maybe make final determination once they have this information. There's a lot of work that has to be done in terms of calculating, providing information to taxpayers. And by sometime this summer, we're sort of flexible with that date because there's going to be different degrees to which different assessors have to make these calculations and the number of calculations they're making. We're keeping the summer date kind of flexible at this point in time. But we're trying to keep it where no final determination would not be made until the summer of 2009. But we are in a situation right now where there is some confusion because the assessors have many counties, especially in the central part of the state, where there are a number of applications that have to be processed. The assessors there have to go through and do the appropriate calculations. Taxpayers are uncertain in terms of what this body might do in terms of reacting to some of the new provisions that were put in place. And one of the things I would like to really encourage, if possible, that the legislature does take some relatively quick action or give some direction on some of these issues that are being confronted by the assessors and taxpayers. Hopefully, maybe we get some direction before session, because as we get further into the year, not only assessors have to administer this law, but they have to administer current law with respect to other equalization issues. So with tight budgets, it's going to be tough. The other thing I want to really emphasize, too, is that we've been trying to work very hard with the assessors to get some uniformity, consistency on classifying this property as productive, non-productive, 2A versus 2B. And as both Jody Hauer and House Research indicated, the new legislation that was adopted last year gives a little more impetus to trying to get some consistency out there amongst the assessors on that. The challenge is still there, though, because as Jody especially emphasized, there's still going to be a lot of judgment calls trying to determine what land is in production, what land is not. What we are trying to do is work with the assessors, and I think it's going to take maybe a year or two to get the right guidelines in place, but I think it's essential that the department work with the assessors to get some consistency amongst the assessors, not only in terms of defining general terms of what productive land and non-productive land, but some general categories underlying that, such as pasture land, wetland, slough, fence line. So we have some consistency in terms of the terminology and the use of the property. So I just want to let the committee know we are trying to work with the assessors to try and obtain that consistency. We can get guidelines, everybody thinking off the same page and making these determinations, but because of the mixture of topography throughout the state, you may have some different outcomes. For example, one of the provisions in new law says impractical to value separately. How that might apply to southeastern Minnesota or the central part of the state versus northern part of the state may vary. We're trying to get some consistency amongst the assessors that when you look at property that has these sloughs, that they have these small acres of wetland anyway, the windbreaks, the drainage ditches, what have you, that those kinds of property, even though in some cases the assessor can practically separate, even put a value on them, from a practical point of view, they're part of an integrated part of the productive land. So we're trying to get some consistency with the assessors to try and identify those properties and treat them as, in this case, impractical separating, treat them as part of the productive land. You get to southeastern Minnesota, you could have these slopes, you could have larger areas of gully land that's sort of separated from the rest of the sort of landlocked. You might have some larger acreage that might be falling into this non-productive 2B land that would be considered to be part of the 2A. So what I'm trying to say is that we're trying to come up with some subjective criteria all assessors to work from. Hopefully, they will use that criteria. The outcomes, in fact, could be somewhat different depending on the topography of the different parts of the state. We do feel that it's going to take a couple years to maybe sort this thing through. One of the issues that we have more specifically from working with the assessors is that some of the classifications that assessors now base it more on valuation principles rather than on classification of use principles. But we're trying to be able to bridge those kinds of applications as well. So with the new legislation, I think there's some challenges, but I think there's also a need to try and get some uniformity in the definition of productive versus non-productive, because the policy decisions that the legislature takes forward in terms of what land would be subject to preferential treatment and what land would not is still going to have to be predicated on some uniform classification and identification of use. John, did you want to add anything else?
Okay. Any questions for Revenant? Seeing none, thank you. And we got your number. We may need your advice a little later or maybe next week, too. Get the assessors up here. I think we have Winona, Hennepin, Stearns, and Wright County. Kind of ground zero for a lot of this stuff. The pages can get chairs up there for them. Just grab one from the table there, yep. Welcome to the committee. As you proceed in any way you want, please introduce yourself and for the tape and go ahead.
Good morning. I'll start. I'm Steve Hack, and I'm County Assessor in Winona County, and I am President of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. So we have a we put a position paper out that I believe you all have copies of, and Mr. Tom May from Hennepin County will be reviewing our position paper for us.
Mr. Chair, members, Tom May, I'm the Hennepin County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Legislative Committee for MAO. Briefly covering the position statement that is part of your packet that is put together by our association and approved by our executive board. First of all, we want to thank the Department of Revenue of the legislature and legislative staff for the hard work they've put in on the Green Acres issue over the last couple of years. It's a difficult issue, and we believe that the difficulty really lies in the diversity of the state of Minnesota. From our farmland predominance in the south to predominantly woodland in the north, and to the metro area where we've been administering Green Acres for over 40 years and thought it worked pretty well. So all that experience and all the difference of types of land really make it a difficult process to write the language. But we at the same time realize the importance of consistency across the state, and the revenue has been working very hard on trying to establish that consistency. The position statement really deals with four main factors that we think are important to look at in the language that was passed for 2008. The first one is MAO supports a full grandfather. That's what we supported in the past, and we still do. That would mean that the three-year payback remains the three-year payback. That, we think, would remove a lot of the confusion. It would not force people to make a choice. And I guess with the seven-year payback, for the first time, it creates a problem where we're asking people to pay back taxes without a sale of the property to generate that revenue. So it does create a new wrinkle that we think is a problem. The second thing is the determination of the value on non-productive land moving forward. We think that language is cumbersome. It really doesn't address the assessment process, and we think that needs to be looked at and adjusted or eliminated. Third one is the trigger mechanism that's in the statute that requires payback on the transfer. We think that should be looked at and broadened so that family transfers would still qualify to remain in Green Acres.
I want to interrupt you right on that point. Family transfers, immediate family, distance family, and or why would it matter if it's a family member as long as the piece of land is being utilized in the same manner? I mean, a lot of times we have a neighbor who might take over an operation when there's no kids to buy a piece or to move into a piece. Do you have an opinion on what is a family member and or why not anyone who continues the same usage?
That's a very good point. I think that our position is mainly that that trigger mechanism is too tight and needs to be broadened, and I guess it would be the legislature's discretion to decide how broad we make that and what we allow to continue in Green Acres. The fourth point in the position statement is we feel it's important to reconsider the qualification of CRP, RIM, and CREP land in Green Acres. With that, I pass it on.
Gary Grossinger, the Stearns County Assessor. I'm also part of the Legislative Committee, and I just kind of want to brief the committee on the status of Green Acres in Stearns County. This past summer, we mailed out approximately 8,600 applications to property owners that were qualifying for Green Acres in my county. As of yesterday, we received about 5,000 of those applications back. Approximately 3,000 of the applications requested to remain in the program. So we've got about 3,000 that didn't return, 3,000 that requested to remain in the program, and the balance we're going to have to calculate a tax come this summer to indicate what their tax difference is on their non-productive land. It's been a major task. The major concerns that my property owners had, and I had a series of 11 meetings, approximately 1,200 people showed up to those meetings. Their major concern kind of mirrored the MAO's position statement. They were concerned about CRP. They're concerned about transferring to family members in the valuations of those Green Acres. So it's this whole bill passed in the legislature has been a major task for my county. I know it's cost us substantial dollars in administration. So thank you for letting me speak.
Very good.
Oh, can I? I think I'm next. From Winona, I'd like to give a little instance. Down in southeast Minnesota, our topography is a little bit different than lots of the other parts of the state. We're approximately 50% tillable, 50% non-tillable, and the term that I hear from my farmers regularly is economic unit. You know, they feel their farm is one economic unit. They have some real consternation with us trying to determine what's productive and what's non-productive. They just feel like their farm is their farm and that it shouldn't be separated. I think one of the things that we've run into, we didn't quite have as many as Mr. Grossinger, but we have four stacks of applications and surveys sitting about this high around my office that we, you know, have to get around to someday. It won't be this year. And, you know, so that's become an issue. And I think one of the other problems that we're running into is the law specified that after May 1st, any new transfer, the people are out. And we've just had numerous paybacks of properties that have transferred sometimes from father to son where half their land is non-productive and they had paybacks of thousands of dollars on those properties with frankly no transferring of money between the properties, but you know, we get ours. And I think that's been a real issue for a lot of our property owners as well.
Do you have an opinion on should it be contiguous versus non-contiguous? Should it be homestead versus non-homestead? I mean, a single owner can have, you know, acreages a mile away as opposed to a contiguous economic unit, as you called it, and or we can own more than what we can homestead to a point. So what's your view on that?
Well, I think for us, again, I'm speaking, you know, for southeastern Minnesota. I know what the world's different when we get to other parts of the state. You know, I think for us, we've been pretty consistent that, you know, the contiguous to the homestead, you have to, you know, that's fine. You have farmland. If you have woods, that's extra. That's okay. If you have non-contiguous property, that has to be agricultural property. We're not allowing somebody 4 miles away to have 40 acres of woods. That's not attached to his homestead. We've always called that non-homestead, you know, some type of non-homestead, non-agricultural classification. You know, if on that piece 2 miles away, if there's agricultural land included there, then that would extend to his homestead.
Okay. My name is Greg Cranber. I'm the Wright County Assessor. I want to thank the chair for having us. I'm speaking on behalf today of the Wright County Board of Commissioners, who asked me to come down here. There's been a lot of development pressures in Wright County, and we're one of the most affected counties by the recent changes just because of our sheer proximity to the metropolitan area. The Green Acres program under the old, you know, prior to these changes, in my opinion, worked very well in Wright County. It equalized taxes from amongst the farmers from the eastern part where values are very high to the western part where values are more of an agricultural value. We have approximately 6,400 parcels currently enrolled in a program encompassing over 300,000 acres. Under the new, you know, breaking down productive and non-productive, I believe that over 30% of our currently enrolled land would be considered non-productive and no longer qualified. We have over 8,000 acres enrolled in CRP and RIM and other programs out there to protect, you know, many agricultural programs to assist those farmers. In September of 2009 here with the changes, we basically took all of our appraisal staff, all of our clerical staff, and started dissecting every farm into these productive and non-productive buckets. After going through this process, I strongly agree with Mr. Hacken that a farm operates as one economic unit, and it's very, very difficult for us as assessors to dissect these into these different buckets. In November of 2009, we sent out over 3,500 commitment letters to property owners, and we had just because of the complexity of the forum and the reaction from the public, we did have for weeks, we literally had 200 people a day in our office. Most farmers asking, you know, what should I do? What are my options? And will you please explain this further in detail to me? In December of 2009, we sent another 1,800 those commitment letters out to property owners who did not reply on the first setting. All in all, our administrative costs in Wright County to dissect the farms into the productive, non-productive buckets and to provide these mailings are in excess of $150,000. And on behalf of the Wright County Board, they just wanted to relay their concerns on to this committee and you know, the administrative costs, the potential environmental issues, and the negative impact that it may have for some property taxpayers or some hardships that it may bring on because of the property values in our area. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Kind of partially answered the question, but a follow-up to Gary on your workloads. Have you had to hire additional people, pay overtime, and has this kept you from getting your other regular duties done in a timely fashion?
There's a point as administrator that I have to draw the line in the snow and say, what is my priority? And I've kind of put Green Acres now on the shelf, and my priority now is my 2009 assessment. I am already into my overtime budget, so I'm afraid what I'm hearing, there's hints of freezes and, you know, staff cuts, so if I don't have gray hair, I'm going to.
Okay. Any other questions for the assessors? Otherwise, Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr.
I don't think you have any Green Acres in your area.
Very little, Mr. Chairman. So, but still, I am concerned about some of the issues. And we just heard, gentlemen, we just heard the legislative auditor's office talk about the preservation of farmland is, at best tenuous with this program. And I'd like your thoughts, if you have any, on that. Do you see this as a benefit to preservation of farmland, and can you give us a little bit of idea in your areas if it's working at all, or if there's some things we can do to preserve some of the farmland around the areas? And also, one other thing, I'd like to, can you toss us out an estimate of how much your farmland is, how much you've increased the value of your farmland in your area?
I think I'll start just being Stearns County. My eastern county is subject to a lot of development. Around St. Cloud, Wade Park area, we have a number of family farms that still exist. And again, values on those particular farms around the city of St. Cloud may be $25,000 to $30,000 an acre, whereas the agricultural values are probably in the neighborhood of $2,000. I did calculate a payback on one particular family farm, and the payback would have been $80,000 if he would have unenrolled his non-productive land.
Okay. In Winona County, we're a little different. What kind of got us into Green Acres was we have a lot of land that's been selling to Twin City and Chicago residents for hunting and recreational purposes. That was, if you go back into the day, as my older folks in the county tell me, that kind of land used to be either thrown in for $100 an acre or almost given away as part of the farm. Well, today, I would say the minimum sale we see on that type of land is $2,500 an acre. You know, never farmer to farmer, always, somebody to somebody outside. And I think what the Green Acres has done in Winona County has probably stopped those farmers from, from having to experience high taxes, and I think it's kept more of those lands into the farm rather than, continue to be split up and, had other types of pressures put on them. So that's kind of where we're at. Our that kind of land sells for anywhere between $2,500 and $4,000 an acre. Green acre values on it have been $800 an acre in the past, so it's not the big numbers Mr. Grossinger has, but when you have hundreds of acres of it, it adds up pretty quick.
Yeah. Could you, one of you, explain to me, going back to this rural vacant land, how would you account for that? You have 0.7 acres of wetland in the middle of an 80-acre field. Is that rural vacant land that you're going to value differently than the 0.7 acres of woods on the edge of the field versus and on and on? How are you approaching that?
I can tell you from my county what we're doing is if it's the tree lines, if it's the little ditches that are running through the fields, the rock piles that sit around, we're considering that impractical to separate. If I've got a property that's 400 acres and 150 of the, has got woods or side of the hill in one portion of it, that we can obviously separate. And, you know, the rules, as I see them today, would be that we would separate that into 2B land.
Because potentially when you're valuing the property, so if you can't separate, you're just putting it in a category as wet waste, and that has a lower value then for property tax purposes. The only time you get hit higher is if you have 10 acres of woods that you're able to separate and possibly would have a higher value if it was, say, on lakeshore or...
We have no swampland, so that really isn't an issue. We have hills, and the hills are wooded. The hills are what's selling, so we set minimum values. Right now, our minimum value on anything is $2,500 an acre, and you know that's where we're at on that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, in Hennepin County, just for an example to answer your question, we have a lot of farms that have been protected by Green Acres. So we have farming operations, one right across the street from the Mall of America out to Western Hennepin, where we have a lot of farms. But I would say that our land values, if they were in developable areas that had services, were up to $200,000 an acre at one time. Of course, that's changed now in the last 2 years. But very big, large differentials between market value and what they were paying on ag, because I think our ag value for 2008 was $3,500.
And Mr. Chairman, in Wright County, our values on the eastern border obviously are quite high, you know, bordering the Hennepin County border. For residential development, you know, land in that area has historically sold for between $40,000 and $70,000 an acre. On the land on the western part of the county is more true ag, where it's selling at $5,000 to $6,000 per acre. So the eastern part of the county, Wright County, is very affected. As far as you know, what's happened with the economy over the last few years, we are making substantial changes. You know, if you look at the foreclosure rates in the state of Minnesota, we're quite high in that area. We currently have over 5,300 residential lots that are currently available for sale, and that market is suffering with, you know, 1,100, 1,200 foreclosures occurring each year here for the last couple of years. As far as the breakdown of productive and non-productive, we have 298 lakes and three rivers, and just the topography of our nature, especially on the northern part of our county, is very difficult, and we're doing the best we can as far as if it's actually an agricultural use, like a windrow or a rock pile or some of those issues, you know, those we are treating as impractical, but other than that, we're dissecting these to the best of our ability. We felt it was the only way that we can maintain consistency countywide. You know, if this person has 5 acres of waste and that's considered productive, and the other one is 5 acres and that's impractical, you know, we didn't want to have that inconsistency, so we're dissecting it probably a little more than some of the other counties.
Okay, very good. Hey, miss, if you get $200,000 for your land, I think you'd be vacationing in the Caribbean. We wouldn't see you here.
Mr. Chairman, I would not be going north of the winter. I'd be going south of the winter. Like,
thank you. Anyway, thank you. Well, we're going to count on you. We appreciate your paper. You're on the front lines. I put a lot of weight in your testimony today, so thank you to the assessors for coming in. Farmers Union, followed by Farm Bureau. The pages will pass out. We have some handouts here. See, we're down to one page right now. I don't know what happened to our other guy. Welcome. Please proceed in a timely fashion. We're going to continue to hum through now.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to do 30 seconds. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Relations with Minnesota Farmers Union, and these pages passing out my testimony. Very quickly, Farmers Union supports a full repeal of the changes made, strongly supports a full repeal, and then setting up a task force to look at and take some time to implement the changes. However, if that's not practical, you'll see on my testimony we have 7 or 8 things that we'd like to have you address, such as the non-productive land, the payback, a lot of things you've had, and CRP land that you'll hear from some of these gentlemen. I'd also urge you to act quickly, and farmers are making life decisions with these, and I think that's really important. You see farms that have been in their families 100, 150 years, and they're having to decide what to do with this land. So with that,
welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is John Hansmeyer, and I'm here this morning with my son Joshua. We farm south of Foley, which is in Benton County. Our farming operation consists of growing corn, soybeans, hay, and some years harvesting logs from our wooded land. I am proud of the fact that I am able to continue to farm land that has been in my family for over 95 years. Let me start with a little history. I signed up for the Green Acres program in 2006, the first year that it was offered in Benton County. I thought it was a wonderful program for several reasons. I liked the idea that farmland would be taxed at a different rate than residential and commercial property, as well as the fact that if land remained in the agricultural production, whether it was sold or transferred to the next generation, the land would stay in the Green Acre program and no penalties would be assessed, thereby providing an incentive for retired farmers who had no family interested in continuing to farm to sell to a younger farmer rather than a developer. The incentive would be that the farmer could sell to the younger farmer at a lower price, avoiding large sums of back taxes had he sold to the developer. The young farmer would be able to purchase the land at a more affordable price per acre, thereby ensuring that agriculture would remain strong in our state for generations to come. Now let's move to the present. The new changes that were made last year in the Green Acres program are not good. Now when land is sold or transferred to the next generation, the deferred tax amount has to be paid going back up to 7 years on so-called non-productive land, whether the land stays in agriculture or not. In reality, if this law remains, the heirs would have to sell part of the land to pay the back taxes. And I thought one of the goals of the Green Acres program was to help keep farmland in the hands of the family farmers, which would keep agriculture strong in Minnesota, not to tax it into extinction. One of the new changes in the Green Acres program is that of non-productive farmland. Non-productive farmland is being defined as woodland, grasslands, not cut for hay or pasture, ditches, wetlands, CRP land, RIM, and other state and federal conservation programs. This land would no longer be eligible for the Green Acres program. For example, on my farm, the non-productive land would be the woodlands, ditches, and low-lying grasslands along the ditches that are currently enrolled in the Conservation Reserve Program, otherwise known as CRP. This non-productive land roughly makes up 25% of my total farm acres. This is not unusual for Benton County, which the state assessors classify as Region 3. Region 3 consists of about 9 counties, which is the land from Stearns County east to the Wisconsin border. In talking with Brian, my county assessor, it came to my attention that roughly 75 to 80% of the farmland enrolled in the state's Green Acres program is from this region, which has a high percentage of this so-called non-productive land. If this law remains, much of that land will be abandoned by farmers and let go to the state by tax forfeiture, not a money-making situation for the state of Minnesota. The reason this will happen is because wooded lands have the highest taxable value in Benton County, higher than most tilled land. This is because of developmental pressure within the county. If the farmers are not allowed to leave woodlands, grasslands, and CRP lands in the Green Acre program, one of two choices are left. If the woodlands are on high ground, the trees will be removed and the land will be brought into production. The land that can't be brought into production will be parceled off from the productive land and left to the state through tax forfeiture. Wildlife habitat would also suffer, and there will be no longer as much incentive to leave buffer strips along your waterways and ditches, therefore endangering water quality. CRP land will be lost as contracts are not renewed and the land will be brought back into production. For these reasons, I ask on my behalf, myself and my family, as well as current and future generations of Minnesota farmers, please repeal the 2008 changes to the Green Acre Bill and return it to its original, which was to help the true farmer, the one who makes their living by farming their land, all of their land. In closing, I'd like to say that in 2006, I signed a contract to participate in the Green Acres programs with the state of Minnesota. When I sign a contract, I am obligated to honor the conditions of that contract. I expect the state of Minnesota to honor that contract as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Caproth. I farm near Foley.
John, can you spell your last name for me?
K-H.
Okay. Thank you.
We bought this farm, and my wife and I, in 1956, we farmed it all the time, and as we're getting older, you have to do it a little different than you used to. So when I hear all this today about the different classifications of land, when I bought this farm, other than a few pieces of trees, it was all farmland. It is shown on the old maps as corn shocks, for those you know who know what that is. But because of the erosion, I have put some of it to CRP, which now puts me in a position that my taxes will be higher. I guess what I don't understand, back in them years, we were given awards for outstanding conservation farmers in our community and from Benton County, and now, under this program, we are going to be taxed out of them because there's not enough income coming from them because the CRP rate is too low to even, it's about $10 lower than rent. So, thank you.
Hey, thank you. Anyone else got anything to say?
Mr. Chairman, members, just a little irony of calling CRP ground non-productive land. In order to be eligible for the conservation reserve land, the land had to be in agricultural production 4 out of the last 6 years.
Right. And CRP isn't a permanent program either, so it's a set period of time. It's interesting to note in your county you're assuming that CRP is worth more than the tillable land. That might be the case. In our case, CRP would be worth less to the tillable land, so you'd have a lower tax rate overall. At least that's how I would appraise it, as worth less in our area. So, all right, well, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Farm Bureau. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself, whatever order you want, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Fran Miron from Washington County. Just want to make a real brief statement that Farm Bureau's policy is very similar to the policy expressed by Farmers Union just prior to us here. My wife is here with me today. We own and operate a Century Dairy Farm in Cuba, Minnesota, in Washington County. There are three generations that currently live on that farm. My son, who farms with us, represents the fifth generation on our farm. And we've been in the Green Acres program, I believe, since the inception. We farm about 700 acres. I actually pulled my tax statements yesterday from 2008. The market value on our tax statements for 2008 amounted to $7,562 per acre. Our green acre value was $3,317. So I think that falls in line with some of the information you had received earlier. Some of the property that we farm is actually valued at over $70,000 an acre, that land that's within the urban service area of the city of Cuba. And yet we're able to continue to farm that land at a reduced tax rate because of the Green Acres program. And so we want to thank the legislature for at least maintaining the Green Acres program. Washington County is rapidly developing. I find it somewhat ironic that just a few years ago, the county passed a land and water legacy program, which charged a tax on all residents of Washington County to maintain open space. And here we are now trying to take away some of the Green Acres benefits that are provided on that open space. I also find it ironic that we have a program that we fought long and hard for here in the legislature, the Livestock Investment Grant Program, in which the state of Minnesota encourages livestock production within the state by providing grants. And by the way, I was an applicant last year. I didn't receive the grant, but we invested about $150,000 in our dairy operation last year alone. We did not receive that grant, but it is money that's become available, and I find that ironic again that here we have a program that works, that helps farmers maintain agricultural operations in our county and other counties across the state, and we're creating some changes to that program to I think in some ways discourage farmers from remaining within it. Our farm has long participated in conservation programs. We had land in the Federal Land Bank years and years ago. We participated in the set-aside programs that the federal government had, the RIM program the state of Minnesota provided, the CRP program, and we actually have contracts that we've signed with NRCS a year ago to provide buffer strips, and I know buffer strips have been an important issue before this committee and before others. We view those conservation programs as an integral part of our farming operation. However, if I'm going to leave buffer strips, that now becomes unproductive land and would no longer be eligible for Green Acres if, in fact, there was a change in ownership. We have filed our paperwork. We are grandfathered in for the most part. We believe that all of our farm it should be considered an economic unit, and that it's important that it be integrated into the farm unit, because they're an important part of our best management practices, how we manage our farmland. We see that as very, very important. And I'll give you an example. We fence off some wetland areas to keep livestock out of it. This last year, as you're well aware, we had a tornado that came through Hugo. We were without power for 4 days. We were able to open up those areas, allow livestock to go in to get water, which we otherwise would have had to pump, running generators, which we were doing, but you know, on a more limited basis. That land is considered unproductive, and yet it provided a valuable resource for us during that period of time. Much of the lowlands and wetlands that are on our farm actually helped my father survive the Great Depression. It provided valuable forage during those years of drought, and we've suffered, as you may well know, a number of years of drought here, even in the most recent past. There are a couple other issues, and they've been touched upon, so I'm going to be very brief, but family transfers. We've got a son that's involved in our operation. My wife and I are in the process of doing some estate planning. Any type of transfer of property into an LLC or some other form that allows us to be fair to all of our children, we have six children, could potentially create a transfer that we would lose our Green Acres eligibility. So I'm very concerned about that, let alone just the family transfer itself that's not allowed. In addition, for sales, we've been wrestling with the drainage issue on our property for quite a number of years. The district court has now ordered the watershed district to commence condemnation. That condemnation is going to occur, and when that occurs, and we're happy with that decision, by the way, but when that occurs, there's going to be a sale on our property. All of the unproductive land as a result of that forced sale will no longer be eligible for Green Acres. Now, that'll be an interesting process to deal with, because does that become a taking as part of the condemnation, and the watershed district as an entity of the state, are they going to have to pay us now for that loss of, for the Green Acres payback that's going to have to occur, and then also for the loss of Green Acres for future years. So it's an interesting issue that that comes forward. The other issue I just wanted to bring your attention to is we had on a parcel of land, the final parcel that we bought from my mother and dad, a 50-acre parcel, was actually paid off in 07. We didn't get down to the courthouse, but the deed was registered in August of 08. That's going to trigger a payback on Green Acres on the unproductive land. So there's all these issues that that we're dealing with as farmers that we're very, very concerned with.
Thank you. I'm Bob Marg. I'm from Winona County, Steve Hackens area. I'm president of the Farm Bureau for Winona County. We've had quite a few issues. Our annual meeting for Winona County, 90% of the time was spent on the Green Acres. Steve Hacken actually came and spoke. A few of the things that, one of which I found out yesterday is my wife had inherited land, 126 acres, it'd be about 3 years ago when her mother died. Well, we finally got it settled up between the three sisters, and yesterday by talking to Steve Hacken, I found out that because it was registered in September, we now owe $1,662 back for it, because part of it is considered to be non-productive. Even though my father-in-law had logged part of that and had made over $35,000 off of logs on it, we now have a logger who wanted to come in again and who says that right now there's about $15,000 worth of logs, and if we hold it for another 10 years, they'll grow enough where we'll probably get close to the 35,000 back. But yet woodland is not productive. It's something that was hit real hard at our annual meeting, that why isn't woodland productive? Dwayne Hutton, who I do my taxes through, who runs an agri-advisory service, says on the IRS forms, the logs are considered agricultural products. So if they're considered agricultural products, why isn't the woodland considered ag? It brings up issues. Another thing is I sell off, we trim our woods out, poor trees, different stuff, and sell the wood off for firewood. Besides heating our own house, my dad's house, my uncle's house, and a friend's house. So it gets to the point where not only will I be penalized, or am being penalized for the changes last year, and we followed all the rules up to that point. The state is the one that changed the rules on us, and I don't think it's fair that when they change the rules in a program, if they're going to have people get out because of transfers and stuff, there should be no penalty on it instead of the $1,600. On another issue, the CRP land, most of that is environmentally sensitive land. I know we've got it on my home farm plus on the farm that my wife inherited. And the ASC office pushed us very hard, soil and water, to put CRP land in, because we were having some trouble with, we have a stream, spring-fed stream on our property, and I got only 7.7 acres in, but it's above the stream. And at 7.7 acres, we had farmed in five strips, and we still had erosion problems on it. Now we put half an acre of corn on it for food for the animals in the area. Last year, walking through it and looking at it, I picked out two turkeys that were nesting, and there's numerous other birds and stuff that nest in there. Plus, there's food in there for the deer and stuff through the winter, and the turkeys and all that. So, to me, that's something that deserves some concern, too. And I just don't understand that the state should penalize us for doing a good job on conservation.
Good. Mr. Marge, you make some good points. One of the things I'm going to ask the tax researchers, perk them up behind you there, try and think through for the committee how we can maybe, one of the things I think that keeps coming up is these are farmers deriving income from the land. How do we ascertain that? Could we put together a requirement that either the landowner or the renter has to be filing a Schedule F, which is farm income? Or is there some way, think through how we could, rather than someone who may come down to Mr. Marge's land, buy that 7 acres for hunting, and even though he's deriving income off, he probably wouldn't be filing a form for farm income on those 7 acres. So just something to think through before next week.
Mr. Chair, Fran Muron, I also serve as mayor of the city of Hugo and involved in legislation at a local level. And, the reality is, no matter what program you create, there's always going to be a certain level of abuse. And at some point in time, you look at how can we curb that abuse or make the program better. And I think that's what the legislature was trying to do here. Washington County, a number of years ago, actually saw that abuse. And I know Washington County essentially wasn't here. But what they specifically did that particular year was require all property owners to come in and reapply for green acres. So even though you've been on green acres, they required a reapplication process. And as part of that reapplication, they wanted to see the farmer's Schedule F,
okay,
which is what you mentioned. And that eliminated much of the abuse without all of the right dollars and time and administrative work that's going into.
So I concur. Maybe there's a way to annually re-up and prove that it's being utilized for farm.
Thank you. My name is Norman Varner. I live outside of Buffalo.
Norman, can you spell your last name for me?
V as in Victor, A-R-N-E-R.
I got it here. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I've never seen as many farmers as concerned and questioning at a meeting as there was at the Rockford Town Hall. Nobody knew for sure what they should do, and they aren't sure yet whether they did the right thing. And it probably isn't going to solve all the problems. Iowa did a research on farm ownership in 07, and the 55% of the farm owners were 65 years of age or older. And of those 55%, 38% were 75 or older. In that meeting at the Rockford Town Hall, there was a lot of gray hair. Land ownership is something that older people keep part of for a long time. They eventually hope to pass it on to their relatives and heirs, hopefully in better shape than it was when they inherited. Land stewardship is one of the things that we hear always, whether it's from the ag teacher, whether it's from the government agencies. And that's one of the things that I think you're missing out on. When you say, well, this unused land isn't necessary, we've got too much highly erodible land, too much water still runs downhill. It ends up in these swales and dips and stuff, gets a chance to slow down. If there's nutrients in it and sediment, they get filtered out. And it's just a necessary part of an agricultural program that works. We hear this every day. We got to use minimum tillage or ridge till or no till to cut down on the erosion. We're supposed to use less fertilizer, only the amount we need. Soil test every 3 years. And part of this land is something that we grew up with as kids. We probably are looking at the same trees today that were there as younger trees back in the 1940s. It's you kind of get an attachment to land. It isn't like a car where you wear it out and you sell it to the scrap pile and they make a reinforcing rods or something. Land is something that we should take care of and hand from generation to generation. We can grow food on it. We also get a lot of advantages that same people maybe don't think anything about it, but 80% of the wildlife in this nation is on private property most of the time. They use it for nesting and shelter for snows and everything else because it isn't. And the part that they like the best is this so-called unused land because that isn't disturbed. But I think with these changes, there's going to be more of this land is going to be cut. There's going to be more of it that's plowed, and a pheasant doesn't have a chance in a hayfield nowadays. We cut 4 or 5 times a year, and they just can't lay their eggs and incubate them quick enough. But if they're lucky enough to get scared off and go into this so-called unused land, then they're okay. The second hatch will probably do okay. I think the support of the natural environment is as much should be a bunch of the figure as supporting the bare farmland. I think we've got to protect them both.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Varner. Those pheasants wouldn't be safe if Hamilton and I were out hunting on your land either. So if you got pheasants, we want to know about it next fall, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Chairman, any questions that as Farm Bureau members we might be able to answer?
If not, we've got Mr. Raddatz here, and we'll make sure we keep in touch with him. So thank you for coming with your testimony. Ron Drood, followed by Dean Malstad. And again, members, this room isn't used till 1. I'm going to stay as long as we need to. We're going to move through these rest. You can see there's some couples coming up here, too, so it's not as lengthy as you think on the list.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Ron Drood, D-R-U-D-E.
Okay.
Carolyn and I live in farm in North Branch Township of Isani County, and we have since 1970. I also had a small part, in the passage of the original legislation in the late 60s. I'm very dismayed by what is being put on as the goals or the intent of that legislation. I can, in when the original legislation expanded to statewide from the metro area, it was to preserve farms. And at that time, farms were considered to be that block of land. They weren't subdivided into itty-bitty pieces of this or that. It was one farm. And that's why, at the urgings of the Isaac Walton League and others, I went to bat for the Green Acres legislation. You might just reflect on that a moment, that it's called the Green Acres legislation. This legislation really had its origins in Wright County. And it's encouraging to see Wright County presentations here today. Specifically, there were a couple of farmers who were about to sell their farms before sales to pay for sanitary sewer easements that traverse their farms to serve subdivisions. This legislation is all about preserving farms and those lands that the farms contain, giving a landowner ammunition to stave off development. That's what it was all about. It should be in the preamble. Legislation in that era had a preamble that talked about the legislative intent. There are some other intent issues that are coming before the body soon, but I think your researchers should be able to inquire of that or to get committee chairman back here to talk about the intent. Some of us are still alive and kicking. That's intent and goals. The other thing that I think that you really need to consider, this element of super micromanaging these bits and pieces of land, removing program land such as CRP and RIM, which I had a much larger role in RIM legislation than I did in Green Acres. This is not only a betrayal of trust, in my view, it also puts a chilling effect on anybody that's going to attempt to use the easement vehicle as a methodology to preserve land in any way. People are just going to be reluctant to enter into any kind of easement because the rules can be changed. You changed them last time. Very unfair, in my opinion. Finally, it's environmentally unconscionable to talk about land as being non-productive. If you're going to insist on using language of that sort, then you ought to use non-revenue producing. Either revenue producing or non-revenue producing. All land has some productivity. Those of you that understand about carbon sequestration and some of the more current modern views of conservation will understand that. And finally, it appears as though revenue and other departments use a very limited definition of farm activities and farm usage. We came across this in RIM legislation years ago. Somebody from revenue pulled out a very teeny, teeny definition of what farming is or was. If you use the United States Department of Agriculture definition of farm activities, it would certainly include lumbering, timbering, etc. So my characterization of what you did last year as a body was you literally threw the baby out with the bathwater. This was a very, very cost-effective program in our county, Isani, and I'm very dismayed at what happened. I would strongly urge you to repeal this bill, hold the hearings, take the broad testimony, and get on with it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would take any questions.
All right. I think we're good right now. Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Dean Malstead from Wright County, Cokato Township Supervisor, homeowner on 6 acres, grew up on a farm of about 180 with several other acres rented for a period of time, farmed with my dad. I am a business owner in the city of Cokato as well as a commercial property owner in the city of Cokato, so I know what taxation is like and what it is to pay the unfair portion as I pay $2,000 of my taxes directly to my school district alone each year. When it comes to some of the testimony that's been offered before by the various departments or agencies of the state, I understand that more and more as I grow older that they are the messenger and they're not necessarily all of the problem, although there are administrative things that go on in the Department of Revenue and other departments that maybe are outside the scope of what they're intended to do. That's not my issue today. It seems as though they were given directives. And in Wright County, these directives are going to cost the taxpayers across the board in Wright County, including commercial property taxpayers who pay the highest amount in Wright County, even more, to sustain legislation that was largely inadequate in repairing maybe what the deficiency was. It seems to me the deficiency maybe was in revenue, and maybe fair revenue or fair revenue collections across the state. I, as a commercial property taxpayer, I know when Mr. Kramer has to increase his budget in his department to staff up to take care of this, I'm going to pay more taxes in Wright County. And so leave the program alone would be my encouragement to the legislature. When we talk about consistency across the state, as a township supervisor for 6 years, we have tried at different points to institute consistency across a 6-mile by 6-mile area of land, and we can't. We can't make policy from neighbor to neighbor oftentimes because we know that it will change, and we know that we will bind a future board to something that we cannot see or understand right now. We make it our aim every time we meet to not make policy, to try to not be consistent in all things because it's not possible in all things. To provide consistency across the state, as was suggested earlier, I think would be a mistake. I think it would be a broad brush that doesn't fix the problem that we're experiencing. Honestly, the problem we're experiencing in the state is spending, and it's spending on the part of the politicians in the state, whether they be appointed politicians or elected politicians. In that, my question would be, when we look at the 3-year and 7-year look back, Mr. Kramer and I would disagree on whether the 3-year look back is an okay period of time. The 7-year look back, we both agree that's a wrong way to go. My question to not just this body, and I'm not here to pick on anyone here specifically because I have no beef with anyone. My question is to the politicians in the state largely, including the governor's office, is everyone here, if the economic downturn continues to go as it is, as my business takes hits, as other businesses around me and those that we service take hits in their income, and we lose our pensions or we lose some of our daily income, are the pensions of the state employees and the state politicians also available for a 3-year and 7-year look back then, that we can grab into those pockets and take money back into the state coffers? I would move for a full repeal of this if I was able to sit on the floor as an elected official. I don't know that the original program was the best for the state when it was created, but this was not a fix to it, and this is not the way to go about it, including it in an omnibus bill without hearings and without proper input from the public, and it should be looked at again. When we talk about contiguous versus non-contiguous, this would be my last point, would be, as I grew up on a farm, and as I lead in a township on certain issues, and as we as a township board look at our township issues, we look at a 6-mile by 6-mile area, and we look at all of our farms within that area when it comes to drainage issues, encroachment issues, fence line issues, and things like that, as we deal neighbor to neighbor. In a sense, we're a tribe. And in a sense, all of us end up being tribal in certain ways. The state of Minnesota is to the union and different groups of people within the state of Minnesota. You come down to the local unit of a homeowner or a farm and landowner, and my dad's farm is an active money-making piece. His lowland or non-use, or a better term would be non-revenue-generating areas of his farm, help the farmer next door make money because it provides some of the drainage basin for the farm next door. And as we look at Wright County, as we look at Coquito Township, all of our farms end up being very connected. They're very contiguous. And they're as a unit, as a whole, they're all helping one another produce the products and provide those things that the family needs as well as our society needs. And without, if you took an individual farm like my father's and took away his drainage, that's very easy to to set up and make work on his farm. If you took those things away, he would have half of his farmland. You know, there's arguments back and forth whether that's right or not. It doesn't matter. The drainage issues are what they are. And we have currently, for several decades, drained farmland that we've been using. His farmland doesn't work without all those other areas, all those other areas that are non-use areas or low-use areas. So just a lot of things to think about. I'm encouraged to be here and listen to the testimony. I'm thankful for you guys to be here and listen, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Malmsted. We'll bring Neil and Deb Kruger up. I'd also point out, just to be fair, Representative Lincheski and Markhart provided a handout to all the legislators. I know some of the witnesses in the audience haven't seen it. I know there's an assumption this was somehow slipped in and there was no testimony on it, but frankly, the bill was, the legislative auditor's report was heard in February and March. There were three different hearings on it, and there were actually nine public hearings on Green Acres before we adjourned on May 18th, and six of those opportunities we had to amend or adjust. Now, that doesn't mean every legislator was aware what was in these bills, but to be fair to our tax folks, there were a number of public hearings on that bill and opportunities to make adjustments, you know, whether we chose right or not at that time, but we need to be fair to our tax folks, too, that there was a lot of discussion on this issue. Welcome. I assume you were together, right, when I saw the name?
We are together.
All right, very good. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself and proceed as you wish.
Thank you. I'm Neil Krieger. This is my wife, Deb Krieger, and we live in Lake Elmo, and we've had a family Christmas tree farm for the last 55 years in Washington County. And we're here for a number of reasons, but first of all, we've taken the steps and have a plan in place to pass our farm on to our children. Just like I'm the second generation raising Christmas trees in the St. Clair Valley. So we have always run an environmentally friendly, sustainable Christmas tree farm. And, you know, it encompasses many things. We, of course, have woods as well as the open land that we produce Christmas trees in. But we've worked, because we are within the city of Lake Elmo, we've given up some things because we believe that that farm should always be preserved. The city has worked with us, and we are now in a buffer strip that is part of our downtown area of Lake Elmo. And Lake Elmo is facing many development pressures, and so the value of our land is considerable. So one of the things that we want to make sure happens is that as we pass this farm on to our family and then the next generation, that they aren't penalized in some way with Green Acres, because they are already giving, our family is already giving up a lot just by keeping the land open. We've worked with the Minnesota Land Trust with a conservation easement, and we've also worked with the schools, with education. We allow people to come into our farm, we give tours, and we promote the environmental aspects of our farm as well as raising Christmas trees. So we think that the transferring process that's in place today needs to change. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. You are in your work clothes today, and I'm in mine. I'm going to talk about our farm as a complete whole. Thoreau has said, "What a wonderful world we live in, that we have been given the gift of growing the earth." Our farm is about 50 acres, and it is a complete ecosystem of marshes, wetlands, a meadow pond, stream, and woods. It is a complete ag unit. It is not vacant land, and it is not non-productive land. Its marshes hold extra water, allowing small portions to spill over into our stream and pond. We form our fields around these marshes and wetlands. They provide needed habitat and keep our fields from flooding. The woodlands and deciduous trees planted throughout the farm also provide habitat, are aesthetically beautiful, and buffer our fields from wind erosion. It takes 10 to 15 years to grow an average-sized Christmas tree. For every tree we harvest, we plant two or three in its place to repeat the cycle of growing. Christmas trees are renewable, sustainable, and recyclable. Our marshes and wetlands and meadows and streams and woods that all of us have are an equal part to the biodiversity, health, and necessity of our farms as a whole system. What may be fallow land one year will be rotated with another species another year. So it's really impossible to tell what is productive and non-productive. Sometimes fields will be allowed to sit idle for a while to rest in order for the soil to replenish itself. To us, this makes perfect and responsible ecological sense for the health of our farms, no matter what crops we grow in our fields. It would be difficult to determine, then, what is non-productive land, as even quiet land is actively growing beneath the surface. As stewards of our land, we see the necessity of growing things, all things, and the complete and whole diversity of our farms. What affects one part affects the whole and will have a direct effect on its birds, butterflies, frogs, and all the other creatures. Our children's children's children will be left with whatever legacy we leave behind. Surely they will challenge us if we don't make an effort to protect our planet's green fields, growing rotating crops, fallow fields, marshes, meadows, wetlands, woods, and open space. They are all part of a renewable, environmentally sustainable, and responsible whole. We love what we do. We all do. And we choose to keep our farms open, green, and complete. How simple it would be for all of us farmers to sell off our land for taxable developmental interests. But we do what we do because we believe that someone needs to sit on a tractor in the rain and take care of the earth and all living things in their complete and sustainable whole. Thank you.
Very good. And I appreciate your testimony. I think we're hearing a trend through here, members and others, that, and I tend to agree, there is a synergistic relationship between the acres where crops might actually be planted and the surrounding landscape in that unit. And whether you're housing bugs and bees to help pollinate or whether you're preventing soil and other things from eroding off into the wetlands, I think we have to recognize that a farm unit or a production unit isn't necessarily just the tillable acres. And I appreciate your testimony emphasizing that. Thank you. Next we have Bobby King, and then we'll from Land Stewardship, and then Tim Power from Minnesota Nursery will be after that. Welcome, Mr. King. Got about 5 minutes each here or less.
Okay, I can do it in or less, I think, because I'm with the Land Stewardship Project. My name is Bobby King. I think we would agree with everything that's been said here. We would like to see a repeal, and we would like to see a process set up that allows for broad public input. Mr. Chairman, as I was looking at the timeline, it seems like there was an opportunity perhaps for legislators to come and speak to the issue, but as I'm aware of, there was only one time when the issue of Green Acres was on a public agenda, and that time there was lots of public testimony from farm groups and others, and all in opposition to these proposed changes. So I'm hearing a lot of concern from people who try to keep track of what's going on up here, but aren't up here, and they didn't know such substantial changes were on the being proposed. The three things that I hear the most about, people are confused, but the productive non-productive issue is probably the number one. And just to have within statute that concept, we Land Stewardship Project feels is harmful, and other people have spoken to the fact that that land is not non-productive. It's producing clean air, clean water, it's filtering water, it's holding water, it's sequestering carbon. The same thing with the RIM and CSP land. That's wildlife habitat. In fact, it is producing something. That's why we're paying people to do it. We have federal and state programs to pay people to put that farmland in RIM and CSP because it's producing a value that we need that the market doesn't yet recognize. So that should definitely be included back in Green Acres, we feel like. The other issue that's of immediate concern is this payback that's triggered merely by a transfer. So people are looking at right now having a tax bill due because they transferred their farm to a relative, but there's no income coming in. And then as to the larger idea, we would strongly support no payback at all if it's kept in agricultural use. We don't have many programs in Minnesota to preserve farmland. This is one of the few, and it's not perfect, but it was working to a degree, and instead of weakening it, we should look at making it stronger. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. King. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Tim Power. I'm a shade tree grower from Denmark Township, south end of Washington County, and I represent the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, which is about 1,500 often family-owned member firms. I'm concerned a little bit. First, I'd like to thank legislature for a couple of the changes that occurred in the 08 legislation. In particular, Section 3B of the law limits the owner or limits the eligibility of property to those entities owned by individuals with a large number of exceptions. Adding the term beyond family farm corporation or family farm entity, they've listed also associated farm entities, and I believe that was a very helpful change to our situation, in which in many cases we have dual entities issues. We have a land ownership unit and a operating unit, and that can be in the form of a corporation, S-Corp, LLC, etc. One of the changes that was made several years ago for the nursery and landscape industry was to allow any entity that earned 80% or more of its income from the wholesale and retail sale of horticultural and nursery stock could become part of this organization. And yet my land-owning entity is an S-Corp that my business partner in the C-Corp and I also own. So there was question with Washington County when we reapplied to the Green Acres Program after coming out of Ag Preserves as to whether we were eligible. And it took quite a bit of talking on our part to make that happen. The fact that we were qualified under 500.24 helped a lot. Last comment I would make is that as you consider how to verify whether a piece of property is income producing, please beware of asking for just a Schedule F, because we file an 1120 on our operating company. And so I think you should, if you reinstate an income verification requirement, that be allowed. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. I know our researchers are going to come up with just great language for that income requirement. So, next we have Peter Tassler and John Baird, if you want to come up. Grab your seat.
Yep.
Represent Hamilton.
I want to thank Mr. King for his testimony as well, because I would question the broad public input. You know, there was a few committees that did hear this, the Tax Committee, and I believe it was before the Ways and Means Committee as well, but it would have been nice to have it in front of our committee here as well, so we could have got the broad public input from farmers and how it affects them directly. And if I could just make another comment, you know, in agriculture, the farmers are good stewards of the land. And I believe that by passing this legislation, we have done a disservice, and we're actually penalizing farmers and, in essence, promoting the draining of wetlands, the cleaning of trees, the plowing up of critical habitat, and farming highly erodible land. And so, again, it would have been nice to be able to have more testimony and here it's in a number of different committees. So, just a comment.
Good. Thank you. Proceed. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. My name is Peter Tassler, and I'm a part of a family that has a 60-acre farm in Lake Elmo, Washington County. The family farm that has been in our family for since 1869, so about 140 years now. And it is directly affected by development pressures, and therefore is enrolled in the Green Acres program. It's also a place that I cherish deeply. It's a place where my wife and I were married. It's a place that I have many memories of my grandfather. And my grandmother currently resides there now, as she has for about 60 years. Her intention that the land stay together and that it stay agricultural. And our specific situation, about 40 of the 60 acres is under cultivation. Couple acres, the house and the outbuildings are on, and that leaves about 18 that are marginal acreage. There's lowlands on that acreage. It's wet much of the year, and it's used for drainage. In the past, we've fenced off that wetland and grazed cattle, and used it that way. I can remember a time when it was just rolling hills that the cattle walked around and grazed on. Now there's nice homes along the fence line. And so the decision's been made to keep it idle, to be neighborly and keep it idle. So we could just use it as drainage, use it as conservation for wildlife. And our neighbors appreciate that open space. That's part of the reason that they moved there. And they also greatly appreciate not having cattle in their backyard. So now this land is going to be non-productive, even though it serves a functional purpose. And, of course, we can grandfather it into the program. But when the land is transferred to the next generation, our family's going to owe 7 years of back taxes. Even with it passing to the family, no money changing hands, if it stays agricultural, 7 years of back taxes are owed. And this just doesn't seem right to me. It's a real fear that we won't be able to come up with that money. And it's a very big understatement to say that scenario is upsetting to me. And our family, I guess as you already heard, is just one of many that's affected by this. And I'd ask that you repeal the last year's changes. If there's any future changes, that there be public input. And that's where I stand on it. I do want to make a quick comment besides my prepared comment, that I believe I heard the gentleman from the Department of Revenue say that they were working with the assessors to include sloughs and wetland and strips to be included into a productive land, even if it could be valued otherwise. But that's not what the law says in the changes. And from their memo, the Department of Revenue's memo, they very clearly say that this impractical to value separately should only be included in 2A land if it is impractical for the assessor to value separately from the rest of the property. So that's a very big concern of mine. But thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thanks for coming. We really appreciate it. Is John Baird here? Oh, there he comes. And after John, we have Joanne and Daniel Frazier, and they'll be they're the last on my list, but if there's someone we missed, we'll grab you then. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the committee and the team.
My name is John Baird. I have property in Washington County, May Township, and I just wish to make a couple of comments. It's recently the voters in Washington County passed a referendum to authorize the county to sell bonds, the proceeds to be used for preserving critical stream banks, places of unusual beauty where the public can have oversight over the river bluff and that sort of thing. The citizens of Washington County place a high value on open space, wooded areas, and that sort of thing. I believe that one of the reasons that we still have some of those amenities is the fact that we've had this Green Acres law in force, and it's allowed people to retain their property and not subdivide it. Whatever legislation is results from this whole thing, I think should be drawn in such a way that we don't force people to divest themselves of wooded areas and so-called non-productive acres. Incidentally, I was able to sell six semi-loads of red pine and spruce timber off of some of my non-productive acres. I was also able to donate an easement to the DNR for the extension of the Gateway Trail through some wooded areas which are termed as non-productive. I believe that this new legislation is rife with unanticipated problems and unintended circumstances, and I would urge that it would be repealed and a much more thoughtful legislation be drawn in the future to perhaps correct any perceived problems. The Trust for Public Land, incidentally, has a quite extensive study that they commissioned, which demonstrates that open land, wooded areas, and that sort of thing actually add to the tax base in terms of the willingness of people that live near them to sustain higher tax value on their properties. And in conclusion, I would point out that the most valuable properties are, for residential purposes, are usually around golf courses, around lakes, on bluffs along the river, all of which reflect this very value that people place on natural areas, woods, and even wetlands. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baird, and I appreciate your testimony. You brought a very compelling argument to light, which I've thought about often, but I think it's worth repeating. You're exactly right. We're putting a lot of dollars into buying public lands, whether it's Lake Vermilion up in northern Minnesota or whether it's buying lands here in the seven-county metro area. As you pointed out, a lot of bonding money, a lot of referendum money is being put forward where... and that's an argument to that tax shift argument that people are saying, well, your land is in, but you're shifting that cost to someone else, when in reality I tend to agree. I think people value open land, and I think it probably in most cases enhances your property value to have that open land across the street from you rather than a shopping mall or a apartment complex or even a residential development.
I would also like to point out that there should be cognizance of the fact that many people, including myself, have donated the development rights on our land. So even though it's termed non-productive, we can't sell it for development purposes under any circumstances.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. Joanne and Daniel Frazier. Welcome to the committee. Appreciate you being here, and if you'd introduce yourself for the tape and proceed any way you wish.
My name is Joanne Frazier Hansen. I am the third generation owner of the family farm. This is my dad, Dan Frazier. He's the second generation owner. We have a 15-acre farm out in Wright County. I will try to keep this brief. I know that the butt can only endure, and the ears can only hear what the butt can endure. Basically, what I'm here to talk about today is our family farm has been in productive acreage for better than 35 years, and we this year decided to turn and bring our farm to conservation, to CRP. We did sign a 15-year contract with the federal government in the hope that we were going to have a chance to show the future and conserve for wildlife, things like that. We had to, when we signed our contract with the government, with the USDA, we signed for prairie grass seeds, which is a tillable, harvestable crop. But now they do not qualify for Green Acre as of June 19th. We were not aware in any way, shape, or form that the Green Acre Law had even changed. We had no notion, no notice, nothing. All of a sudden, we're standing there going, oh God, we're going to get hit with a 3-year look back plus multiplier or a 7-year look back plus multiplier. And we didn't know what to do. The emotional stress and strain between two generations trying to figure this out, the arguing, the fighting, all of that. Why? Because we didn't know, because we weren't informed. it's not fair to us as farmers, as stewards of the land and conservationists, of what's going to be here for our future, for the kids, the grandkids. There's a herd of turkey, quite literally, that I saw Thanksgiving walking the back property line of our farm. 10.4 acres tillable, in production, 35 years, up until June 19th, and then it went into CRP, and we planted that grass seed, and that was the first year I've seen that herd of turkeys. In 35 years of farming out there, we also have raptors. We have American bald eagles, a nesting pair, up on the northwest corner of our farm. Hadn't seen them before, but this was the first year. They're there. They've made a nest. They had fledglings this year. I'd like to remind you that in our stewardship of our farms and keeping our green acres taxation to try to keep things going for the next generation, I encourage you, please, repeal this.
Thank you. Mr. Frazier?
Yeah, she pretty well covered it, other than the fact that all this time has been productive, the crop has been harvested, been consumed, and now you're saying that we've got to pay back plus penalties. This doesn't fit very good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. I'd ask either Mr. Hines or Ms. Baker, why the 7-year look back? What was your recollection on why we went from 3 to 7? Do you know? Can you? That seems to be a point of contention for everyone, even coming out, why that was changed. I know I'm catching you off guard here.
Mr. Chairman, the House authors of the bill, Representatives Demmer and Coonan, actually had proposed a 7-year on everything, and that was in their bill. And the reason for doing that was the general sort of sense, as brought forward in the auditor's report, that 3 years perhaps was not a strong enough incentive to keep land in agricultural. It was really meant to preserve agricultural land. The back tax was supposed to be the incentive to help you decide to keep it in there, because you'd have to pay back taxes if you didn't take it out. So they went to 7 years on their on everything. And then in the process of the conference committee working out with the Senate, it ended up that the 7 years would just be on this non-productive land.
All right. I do have two more people here, so I didn't realize it signed up. The page just brought them. So, but if you got something quick to add, okay.
No, that's fine.
Sorry, we still have time. David Devon, and Robert Peterson. You can both come up if you want and get comfortable and be ready to go. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Dayon, D-A-Y-O-N.
Okay.
No T, I'm not from that side of the family tree.
All right.
I'm from the other side. I'm a farmer. I'm a horse farmer. I own a farm for over 40 years in Wright County. I have 4 horse barns, 35 to 40 head of horses on a year-round basis. That number fluctuates, may go above or below those numbers. I use it primarily for breeding, foaling, layup, and rehab of horses. I'm required by the state law to register as a feedlot in the county. I'm required by state law to have a livestock health certificate to move my animals either in-state or out-of-state. I make a living in this 24/7. This is my livelihood. Even though the word horse is mentioned nowhere in this bill, the Department of Revenue has taken this opportunity to redefine the horse industry in the state. And I would direct you to a memo that was given to me by our local assessor. The title at the top of it says Jane Grossinger. According to the Department of Revenue, horses are not an agricultural pet, or are not an agricultural product. They are more of a pet. Current law does not allow ag classification if the property is used for commercial boarding of horses unless it is also used for to raise additional agricultural product. That goes on to go into the classification, and at the bottom it says, excerpts from a previous letter. Horses are not considered livestock. Raising a few horses for leisure purposes does not qualify for an agricultural pursuit. I don't disagree with that. We referred to the Robert J. Lasinski versus County of Winona 1988. Though the decision does not specifically involve horses, the court stated that while raising of sheep is an agricultural operation, the raising of a small number is more like a hobby than agricultural operation conducted for profit. The court has repeatedly held that maintaining several horses or maintaining a few animals, such as a dozen rabbits, a half a dozen sheep, or breeding of dogs and cats, does not qualify as an agricultural classification. I guess I don't quite understand how you can take a lawsuit referring to sheep and turn around and extrapolate that into the fact that horses aren't livestock. I won't take up a lot of your time. There's a survey out there done by the University of Minnesota. It deals with the economic value of horses in the state. There are approximately 155,000 head of horses on 3,500 horse farms in this state, just according to this survey. I think it is short in those numbers, but I think it shows a substantial amount of livestock. These horse farms, by nature, are building intensive and not land intensive. We don't raise our own hay. We found out through the years that it's much easier for us to buy all of our forage. I can guarantee myself a better quality of hay, and I can and get larger quantities of it. Myself, I go through 75 tons of hay. Put that in perspective, that's 3 semi-loads a year. I also go through 3 semi-loads of oats per year in addition to another 24 ton of processed feeds. The idea that we have to raise an additional crop in addition to horses to even begin to qualify as agricultural makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. We're the only ones that are specifically called out that we have to do this in order to qualify as livestock. Another qualification for livestock, if you go into some of the other definitions, is that horses must be raised for slaughter in order to qualify for livestock. This is a complete misnomer in the fact that animals are qualified as livestock because of their size, the housing and confinement they require, the odor, the noise, and most of all, the manure management problem that you have. Obviously, if I were to follow these guidelines, I serve as chairman of the local planning commission, someone wants to come in and tell me they want to start raising horses in their backyard, our statute or our ordinance says that they're livestock. No, they're not livestock. I'm not raising them for slaughter. I'm just raising them. So therefore, they're not livestock. Doesn't make sense whatsoever to me.
All right, we're going to keep moving. Representative Hamilton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dan, even if you raise them for slaughter, there's no place in the United States to take them.
Let's not get going on horse slaughter. That's another hearing.
It can be done. I assure you of that.
Thank you. And there is a large and vibrant horse industry in this state, and certainly this committee recognizes them as livestock and productive agriculture. So thank you for that. Mr. Peterson, and then quickly we'll go to Mr. Granis, and then we got to get out of the room. Welcome.
Chairman and members, thanks for this chance to explain to you some problems. I live on a farm that I purchased in 1958 from the estate, and my great-great-grandfather came here in 1870. It has not changed, only a few buildings, but the land itself has never changed. When you talk about the word non-productive, I'm sure he's turning over in his grave, because every inch of that land was his farm. But we have cattails. 30 acres or 25 acres of cattails, which you consider non-productive. So I asked the DNR manager, Mike Mueller, if these cattails were an endangered species. He said no. Well, I said, then I can harvest them. No, you can't. So they are a benefit to the DNR. They are a product, right? So when you say non-productive, there is no such thing. But this is another subject. Maybe I shouldn't talk to you about that now, but Isani County is in the process of their comprehensive plan change. They're into this cluster development. Now, this is not a hypothetical case. It's happened. I have a 40-acre parcel. My neighbor had a 40-acre parcel. He subdivided that 40-acre parcel with the transfer development rights. I checked 2 days ago with the Isani County assessor. She said, and she showed me, I should have a document, but after he sold one lot, that was high times, never another lot was sold, $65,000. Now, the adjacent lots on each side, which are modified building lots, residential, taxes on those lots are $16 and $18. Now, there is no justification in that. Those lots should be taxed as residential lots, no different than any village. And maybe I'm wrong, but so maybe this Green Acres law would prevent that. I don't know.
All right. Thank you for coming, Mr. Peterson. We appreciate it. Mr. Granis, I have your testimony here, and we'll make sure we keep that part of the committee notes. I don't want you to read all three pages to me, but if you can, in a couple
don't
minutes,
tend to even
good.
Repeat any of that.
A couple minutes, summarize, and then you're our final guest here today.
The only thing I want to do is respectfully disagree with statements you received from the auditor. The statements were that the Green Acres purpose was originally only to protect productive land. I was there, helped in the writing of it. It was to protect the entire farm.
So a farm unit is what we're talking about,
farm
economic
unit. That is correct.
Okay.
Secondly, the legislative auditor suggested that this shifts the tax load to others. I won't repeat it, but I've explained in detail in my written memorandum that that is not a correct statement. Third, your legislative research has indicated that last year's changes only impacted the non-productive land. I disagree with that in this respect. If that non-productive land has to be sold off, you're going to have to construct roads and other things through your productive land, or if your non-productive land goes into homes, those people, as you heard one of the previous witnesses here said, they don't want the cattle on the productive land up next to their homes. It does impact it if you're forced to sell off part of your home. And the possible solution when you're coming up with this on the non-productive land is I encourage you to look at House File 99 that tries to deal with that. Maybe you can pull that into whatever you come up with. Thank you, and I'll get out of here.
Well, I appreciate you being here. We've had two people, Mr. Drude and Mr. Granis, who were here at the beginning. So we appreciate hearing from two folks that were around in the 60s when we were dealing with this, and I think it's helped us understand the original legislative intent. Members and audience, thank you for your time on this. We're going to try to put a bill together next week on Tuesday to send down to taxes. Feel free to discuss with our committee administrator or myself in between time. We'll get you which bill we're doing so you can draft amendments. Staff will know that, and we'll see what we come up with. This meeting is adjourned.